Good morning. As Matt has already said, we will be looking at the first chapter of the book of the prophet Hosea. If you're using a church Bible, you'll find it on page 751. And we will read the entire first chapter, verses 1 to 11. So Hosea 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom, and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, "Call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." She conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said to him, "Call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all, but I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen." When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, "Call his name Not My People, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' it shall be said to them, 'Children of the living God.' And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head, and they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel."
On the 16th of September 2008, the financial world was stunned by the collapse of the investment bank Lehman Brothers. Founded in 1850, for over 150 years, it had stood as a pillar of strength in global markets. Investors trusted it, institutions relied upon it, its name carried weight. But beneath its reputation, there had been growing instability. Over time, poor decisions and risky speculation and misplaced trust had left the bank heavily exposed to high-risk mortgage assets. On the outside, everything seemed fine, but there were issues bubbling beneath the surface that had gone on for a long time. And so when pressures mounted from outside, and the bank found itself unable to cover the cost of its debts, what had once been a model of stability and security collapsed almost overnight. The bank failed, and with its failure, it triggered one of the most severe financial crises in history. Its fall was swift, but the underlying weakness had been building for years. Now, in many ways, what happened to Lehman Brothers is a good illustration of what has been happening in Israel as we turn this morning to the story of Hosea. Hosea was a prophet of God. He lived in the northern kingdom of Israel about 200 years after it broke apart from the southern kingdom of Judah following the reign of David's son Solomon. As we come to the beginning of the book, we join the nation of Israel at a time when they are enjoying peace and prosperity. On the outside, Israel is doing well. It looks secure and prosperous. Yet boiling underneath the surface, there are huge issues. As we look at the opening verse of the book, We see that Hosea was called to speak for God during the reign of King Jeroboam, who was one of the worst kings in Israel's history. He wasn't a bad king because he mismanaged the economy, something that is of high importance to us when we look at our leaders today. He wasn't known for being exceptionally cruel to his people, like some nations that we see in the world around about us. His issue was that as their king, he had led the people further and further away from God. See, the nation of Israel were meant to be God's people. He had brought them out of slavery in the land of Egypt. He had watched over them and guided them. He had provided for them a land in which they could prosper. And in doing all of this, he had asked them to worship him alone. But Israel were unfaithful. They had pledged their loyalty to God, but gradually over time they began to worship the gods of the nations around about them as well. Under successive kings they had formed bonds with and copied the practices of their neighbors that the Lord had warned them to keep apart from. And so slowly over time they had betrayed their commitment to follow God alone, and they had become double-hearted. See, unfaithfulness rarely begins with a dramatic betrayal. It usually starts with small compromises, the accommodation of a seemingly small vice, or a quiet resentment, a secret indulgence, or a neglected commitment. A small gap in our loyalty, a slight drifting away from what we promised, a breach that over time becomes wider and wider. Most marriages don't collapse overnight. Ministries don't fall apart in a single day. A soul rarely grows cold in a moment. It usually begins with small compromises in unguarded places and small decisions where devotion gives way to pleasure or convenience. But if left unchecked, these small acts of carelessness and compromise can lead to devastating consequences, which is exactly what happened in Israel. So against this backdrop that we have of Israel's unfaithfulness, God does something shocking. He sends them a prophet to expose their betrayal, to warn them of its consequences, and to call them back to himself. However, instead of delivering a thunderous sermon from heaven, he tells his prophet to give them a picture in his life that will mirror the nation's betrayal. He asks Hosea to show them day by day the way in which they are treating him. And he confronts them with a warning that you cannot carry God's name and yet give your heart to something else. So as we turn to this perhaps lesser known part of the Bible this morning, we should do so understanding that Hosea is a book that exposes unfaithfulness. It challenges waywardness. It speaks of half-heartedness and indifference to God, and it calls us to turn from it. But in doing so, it also reminds us of a God who is supremely faithful, and about how God stands ready to forgive and restore those who turn to him. So over a set of what I expect to be 5 sermons over the coming year, where I'm going to be preaching here, God willing, I want us to work our way through this book of Hosea, focusing on several key passages, beginning today with chapter 1. So if you have a Bible, I would encourage you to have it open to the opening chapter of Hosea. If you're struggling to find it, it comes directly after the book of Daniel, where Colin's been speaking over the past few weeks. And as we work our way through this chapter, I want to do so under the following 3 headings, or with the following 3 focuses. Firstly, looking at verses 2 and 3, I want us to consider a prophetic life. Secondly, focusing on verses 9 to 4, I want us to think about prophetic names, before finally concluding in verses 10 and 11 with the encouragement of a prophetic hope. So let's begin by the first of those points and look at verses 2 to 3, where we see Hosea's call to a prophetic life. Look at verses 2 and 3. We read, when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go, take yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and conceived and bore him a son. So having introduced us to the setting in verse 1, verse 2 begins with the commissioning of the Lord's prophet Hosea. God sets out for Hosea the way in which he will speak to the people for him. And it really is a shocking introduction. Just listen again to what God says in his first recorded words to his prophet. He says to Hosea, go take yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom. God says to his prophet, the one who will speak on behalf of his holy name to all the people of Israel, go and marry an unfaithful woman and have children born of this unfaithful woman. It's an almost unbelievable instruction on God's part when we consider that marriage is a sacred bond instituted by God. In its rightful form, it is a union between a man and a woman to the exclusion of all others. It is meant to be a commitment for a lifetime, a commitment of faithfulness and mutual love that has been instituted by God, and it is supposed to be something that is pure and beautiful. And yet God says to Hosea, go and take for yourself an unfaithful bride. Go and take someone, go and marry someone who is known for their immoral lifestyle. And what is more, as we see the story progress, he is to take for himself a wife who will continue in that way of life, even into their marriage. It is possible that Gomer was a prostitute, someone who earned her living through offering her body to anonymous clients. The language allows for that, but there is also some ambiguity, as in the Hebrew, there are words for that profession that aren't used here. It is perhaps more likely, and chapter 2 seems to affirm this, that she was a woman who had numerous lovers, a variety of partners who supported her and provided for her needs in return for her favors. But either way, it doesn't lessen the impact of what we are being told, which is that God calls Hosea to be his prophet. And he says, I want you to speak on behalf of my holy name, and all the while you proclaim my truth, everyone around about you will know that your wife is unfaithful to you. It's a shocking command from God, and rightly we should ask, why? Why would God want him to do this? Well, as we continue in the text, we see God answers that very question. We read, the Lord said to Hosea, go take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. In other words, he tells Hosea that his life is going to be a living parable. His marriage is going to be a picture of something else, namely the relationship between God and his people Israel. God says, go and marry someone who is unfaithful to you because I want to show my people Israel the way in which they are unfaithful to me. Because they have gone and they have chased after other gods. They have been unfaithful and are an adulterous people. And your life, Hosea, is going to be a picture of that to them. So it's going to be painful. It's going to be costly. It's going to be humiliating. Because that is what the relationship between God and his people Israel is like. And God wants to show them that. You see, as I mentioned earlier, throughout their relationship, God has been like a faithful husband to Israel. He took them out of Egypt where they were slaves. And he entered into a covenant with them on Mount Sinai, where he asked them to be faithful to him alone. And that covenant relationship is very much like a marriage. He had taken them under his wing. He had protected them and provided for them and had promised them all manner of good things. And then when he brought them into the promised land, which was rich and overflowing with everything that they needed, they had taken all of the abundance of grain and wine and oil that the land provided, and they had dedicated it to foreign gods from the nations around about them. And although they still claimed to be his people, and while they still went through some of the motions of serving the Lord through some of their religious practices, even till this time, they had added to that worship other lovers alongside of him. They had begun to worship the Canaanite fertility gods, Baal and Asherah, adopting the immoral practices associated with them, which included sexual rites believed to bring rain and fertility to their crops and to aid in childbirth. So along with this worship of the Lord, they were indulging in sinful idolatry. Likewise, instead of trusting in the Lord for their provision as they were supposed to, they had found their security in other things. In the book of Amos, another prophet who spoke to Israel at the same time as Hosea, we see that at this time the nation of Israel had become prosperous. They'd become materialistic by forming alliances with the nations around about them, relationships that God had forbidden. So rather than relying on the Lord as they should for their security and their provision, they looked to other nations to secure their peace and prosperity. So in short, even though in part they still claimed to belong to God, they were looking to find all that they needed in life, in all manner of other things, and all the while they trampled underfoot the commitment to the one that should have mattered most to them. And so the Lord says to Hosea, I want your life to be a picture for them of the way in which they are treating me. And in due course, the way I will deal with their unfaithfulness. Now, as we consider what is asked of Hosea here, I'd just like to pause for a moment and ask, how would we feel if God asked us to do this? How many of us, I wonder, if we were asked, would have been reluctant to obey this command? Because it's hardly a glorious calling, is it? How willing would you be, ladies, to go and marry the guy who's known for jumping into every woman's bed from one to the next? How willing would we, men, be to marry a woman who did exactly the same thing? Because we're not talking here about someone who once lived like this but is now repentant and who has turned their back on that way of lifestyle. We're talking about someone who is living like this and will continue to live like this even into their marriage. It's hard, isn't it? We should feel compassion for the heartache that Hosea will endure. We should feel sorrow for the hurt and the humiliation that this relationship will bring to him. What is asked of Hosea is not pleasant. But then as we hopefully feel sympathy towards him, we should remember that what he will experience, the pain and the hurt that he feels, is simply an illustration to us of what God experiences every time his people are unfaithful to him. And so by way of application, in terms of what this passage means for us today, we ought to examine our lives in the light of this living parable and ask the question, have we been unfaithful to God too? See, Hosea's wife, Gomer, was part of the covenant community of God. She was one of God's people, but she wasn't living like one of God's people. She was an Israelite who was living like a pagan in a way that God had told her not to live. But she is a picture to us of Israel who were likewise living in the same way. Now, as we will come to see when we get to the end of the chapter, our situation as Christians, for those of us who are believers, isn't exactly the same as Israel's situation here. But there are parallels here for us. And therefore, we should draw from this text a very clear and a very stern warning for any of us who might claim to be God's people and yet who are living idolatrous lives, who say we belong to Jesus and yet who indulge in sinfulness regularly on the side. In Luke's Gospel, in chapter 14, verse 26, Jesus speaks about the need for us to put him first in all of our affections. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. He says if we're going to follow him, if we are going to be joined to him, then he must be prioritized above all things in our lives, even those closest human relationships that we rightly hold dear to. That he must have the chief place in our affections, that we must surrender to him all of our earthly desires, and he will not share that chief place of affection with anyone else. See, when we come to Christ, we make a commitment to follow him. He is not only our Savior, but he is also to be our Lord. And in the New Testament, it is often pictured that the relationship between Jesus Christ and his people is like that of a husband with his bride. And yet how easy it is for us to allow things to get in the way of that close and dear relationship. Perhaps it begins with small compromises, what we would see as little sins or small indulgences, worldly practices that creep into our lives that we think they don't really matter. Activities that keep us from church and from prayer and from the Bible. Little acts of unfaithfulness that pull us away from Jesus until eventually we suddenly realize we're hardly spending any time with him at all. In James chapter 4, verse 1 to 4, James warns his readers about chasing after worldly desires and even praying to God to receive good things from God simply to indulge their own pleasures. He says to the church, you desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Serious words. And they are a challenge for us as we look at Hosea's difficult and painful calling. They are a challenge for us to examine our own lives before God and ask the question, are we being adulterous to Jesus? Are we the ones in this picture that are causing the pain? Are we in our walk with Christ treating him unfaithfully? The message that Hosea lives out through his prophetic life is a clear challenge to anyone who might claim to belong to God, but who are allowing other things to come between him and our relationship with him. Well, as the passage continues, we see that this infidelity comes with consequences, and that God will not put up with their adultery indefinitely, and their idolatry and their waywardness, and that his judgment will fall upon those who are unfaithful. So as we move on in our passage, we see that Israel's unfaithfulness is met by warnings which come in the form of prophetic names. Just look at verses 4 through to 8. I would suggest that probably for most of us today, when we name our children, we tend to pick their names based on personal preference, don't we? Some of us may choose a name to honor our parents or a family member, while others might just simply go through a book of family names. But ultimately, most of us will choose the name of our children simply because we like it. However, in the Bible, what we often find is that parents chose their names because of their meanings. Their names speak about God's purposes for them. In fact, biblical names are so often laden with significance that when God transforms a person's character, he often changed their name. For example, God changes Abram's name to Abraham when God makes him the father of many nations. Saul, the persecutor of the Jews, becomes Paul, the humble follower of Jesus when Christ converts him. Well, as we look at verses 4 to 9 in our passage, we see that the Lord chooses the names of Hosea and Gomer's children, specifically as a message to the people of Israel. Look at verses 3 to 5. We read, so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So God tells Hosea to name his firstborn son Jezreel, as a sign of impending punishment. Jezreel was a place in Israel. It was a city. And it was the place where the former king Jehu had massacred Ahab's sons, who was a king who came before him. And so here God announces that just as Jehu killed Ahab's sons in punishment because of the sinfulness of Ahab's house, there will be another massacre which will be visited upon the house of Jehu and its descendant, King Jeroboam, who currently sits on the throne. In verse 5, God says that he will break the bow of Israel, which basically means that he will remove Israel's strength. God is warning here that there will be judgment visited upon Israel because of their unfaithfulness. He says unfaithfulness matters, and unfaithfulness must be dealt with. He says Jehu's dynasty will come to an end. The northern kingdom of Israel will come to an end. And the strength and the prosperity that they have enjoyed through their adultery with other gods and other nations will meet its end at the hands of the living God. So in naming Hosea's first son, God warns that judgment is coming. Next, in verse 6, we read that Gomer has a daughter. But it's interesting that with this child, as well as her second son that we get to in verse 9, the identity of the father is left ambiguous. In verse 3, it says, Gomer conceived and bore Hosea a son. However, with their subsequent children, it simply says that she conceived and bore a daughter. She conceived and bore a son. Which at the very least leaves open the possibility that Hosea was not the father of these children. And I would say that that's even reflected in the names that they are given. Verse 6, she conceived again and bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. In Hebrew, this daughter would have been called Lo Rumaha. Rumaha meaning mercy, which characterizes the very nature of God himself. It's how God describes himself as he passes before Moses in Exodus 34, verse 6, where he proclaims himself to be the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. So Rumaha was a beautiful name that spoke about the nature of God. But here Hosea is told to call his daughter Lo Rumaha. Lo meaning not or no. She is to be called No Mercy. Why? Because God says, I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. So this name speaks of God's removal of his patience with their sinful ways. It says that his long-suffering has its limits. We often sing in a children's song that we sing, don't we? Mercy is when God does not give us what we deserve. It is the withholding of his punishment. It is the holding back of him bringing against us that which we rightly deserve. But here God says, I will no longer hold off in bringing my judgment against you. Then in verses 8 and 9, we have the birth of Gomer's third child, another son. And here we read, when she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. In Hebrew, his name would have been Lo Ami, not my people. And as we've said, it's quite possible that Hosea wasn't even the father of this child, and perhaps even over time, his appearance would have made that self-evident. However, what we see here is that Israel, by their appearance, by their heart, by their actions, they have shown themselves to not be God's people. They may still go through some of the religious practices, but they are shallow and false because in their hearts they love and serve the practices of gods around about them. Israel has been an unfaithful wife. Their covenant relationship with the Lord is meant to be an exclusive relationship with Israel worshipping Yahweh and Yahweh alone. No other gods are to come into that relationship. No other sinful practices are to be conducted on the sidelines. But Israel has broken the marriage covenant. And Hosea and Gomer are a picture of what Israel has become. And so this is not so much a sentence against Israel, so much as a statement of fact. In chasing after other loves, they have rejected God. And so refusing to accept that, God says, I'm not going to play pretend with you anymore. He says, let's call a spade a spade. The time for playing at being my people is over, for you are not my people, and I am not your God, says the Lord. The warnings here and the consequences of unfaithfulness are terrifying. God removing his protection, God removing his mercy, God declaring that the relationship is a false and a sham. And surely within these prophetic names, as we see God pronounce his judgment on Israel, there is a striking warning to us too. It is a warning against going through the motions only of belonging to God. Turning up to services, going through all the process of worship, but without any real feeling, without any real heart. Perhaps being able to say all the right things to all the right people, but then as soon as we're out of the door, we forget all about God. Because in reality, our hearts are somewhere else. In truth, our affections belong elsewhere. And coming to church is just something that we do. So these warnings should give us pause to think and to consider where we stand in our relationship with God. Do we come to church and yet deep down are we bored with it? Indifferent to it? Do we profess our affections in the songs that we sing, but our lives really bear little truth about those affections in reality? Do we have any real interest in getting to know God better through his word? Do we really care about whether we're walking in obedience to him day by day? Are we playing at being God's people, while in reality our interests lie elsewhere? To Israel, God says, I will not play pretend. So anyone who does not genuinely love God, but who consistently chases after worldly pleasures apart from God, despite how their life may be presented on the outside, is not a child of God. This was true in Hosea's day, and it is true in our day as well. So there are serious questions here, because God warns his wayward people that he isn't going to be taken for a fool, and that unfaithfulness, unless it is dealt with, will have consequences. When Hosea began his ministry, Israel was at peace. It was prosperous and confident in its safety and security. It indulged in the practices of the world around about it without a care. But it was these very acts of compromise and idolatry that would bring the nation crashing down. God sent them, Hosea, to challenge them through his prophetic life. He gave his children prophetic names to warn them of the folly of the way in which they were living their lives, and yet sadly they refused to heed the warning. And in the space of Hosea's ministry, the northern kingdom of Israel would be obliterated by the Assyrians, as God's judgment came upon them. If I'm honest, we have to say that the first chapter in Hosea makes for pretty grim reading. It's uncomfortable, and it would be utterly depressing were it not for the way in which it concludes. Because as we come to our final verses, verses 10 and 11, just as we think things in this passage can't get any worse, and we expect it all to end in darkness, we are given a ray of light as the chapter ends with a prophetic hope. Look at verses 10 and 11. We read, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sands of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. And they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. In these closing verses, God speaks in language that takes us back to his promises that he made to Abraham, and that initial covenant that he made with Abraham when he chose Israel to redeem a people for himself out of sinful mankind. In Genesis chapter 22, verse 17, God spoke to Abraham and made him a promise. He said, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, as the sand is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. These words take us back to God's original promise of salvation. In one sense, it's like going back to God's original wedding vows. So just as in his judgment, it seems like God might fully abandon his people, and in his judgment of Israel, he is turning away from them completely. In our closing verses, we get this ray of hope that in spite of everything that Israel has done, he still reaffirms his covenant of faithfulness and the commitment to the promises that he has made. So even though Israel and God's people have treated him shamefully, and even though his punishment for their adulterous ways will come upon them, and they will be destroyed by their enemies, sent into exile, in spite of all of those offenses against them, he says, I will not give up on what I have promised to do. I will hold true to my commitment to end this curse of rebellion. I will undo this curse placed upon my people who have gone astray, so that where it has been said, you are not my people, there shall be those who are called children of the living God, gathered anew under one head. And for us, standing on the other side of the Old Testament, in the New Testament, it's impossible for us to hear these words and not be carried forward to the gospel, where we find in Jesus Christ another bridegroom who will be bound to an unfaithful people, where we find another who bore the shame that he did not deserve, who loves those who are unworthy of his love, and who laid down his life in the place of sinners in order to save all who would trust in him. See, in these closing verses, we're confronted with a prophetic hope, a hope that points us forward to Jesus. And we see the parallels between Hosea and Gomer and Christ and his church as we move forward into the New Testament. Listen to Peter writing in 1 Peter 2 verses 9 and 10, where he says of the church, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, lo ami, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, lo rumaha, but now you have received mercy. See, despite our unfaithfulness to God, God remains faithful, which we're going to see portrayed in staggering clarity in the redemption of Hosea's wife, when we come to look at chapter 3. As Hosea and Gomer continue this parable of marriage, it points us forward to God's own Son coming and laying his own life down on a cross for unworthy and unfaithful people in order to make them his bride. And so what we need to take away this morning as this first chapter draws to a close is that God will not give up on his people. And that in Jesus there is still a hope for the wayward. There is still a hope here for us today. That God offers forgiveness and it shines brightly for anyone who will come back to him and accept him. In the first chapter of Hosea, we see the unfolding of a very uncomfortable story. It's a story that calls us to ask ourselves very uncomfortable questions. Are we merely pretending to be God's people? Have we grown casual with his grace and his mercy towards us? Are we assuming on his kindness and his love while quietly pursuing other loves in our lives above him? Are we ignoring God and chasing after sin? If the answer to any of those questions is yes, then we need to allow this passage to challenge us this morning. Because God does not warn or discipline his people because he is through with them. He does it because he refuses to abandon them and his love is steadfast. In your affections for God, have you gone astray? Do you feel him calling you back this morning? back to that loving relationship that you once held so dear. Perhaps you hear him calling you for the very first time, calling you from a life lived without him, a life lived apart from him, calling you to come and embrace the loving arms of the one who he sent to save you. See, no matter how far we've wandered, there is still forgiveness, acceptance, and renewal available to us in Jesus Christ. So if we have gone astray, if we have become lukewarm, if we are living wayward lives, then look at the prophetic life of Hosea. Heed the prophetic warnings in these names. And then look to the hope that has been realized in Jesus Christ, God's Son. To his unfaithful people, Hosea's call is to return to the faithful God who loves us in spite of our failings and has given everything that we might be restored to him. So if we have in any way wandered from him, then let us listen to him calling us back.